Evening, everybody. My name is Regan Arnson, for those of you that don't know me, and been with the Sangha for quite a while. And Sarah asked me to share my wayfaring story with all of you fine folks. And she said, you know, it really is to talk about how I got here. And when I heard that, I suggested to her saying, you know, Sarah, I could certainly spend the time in a pretty exciting conversation talking about what I really am and what that concept is, and here, certainly with the virtual surrounding, what that actually meant, and that might be more interesting than to hear about my life. But she, I'm not too unlike Katagiri Roshi, said fairly clearly, Regan, you have to say something about yourself. So with that in mind, I will venture forth. Frank, I think I can share my screen. Want me to try it one time and then see?
Yep.
So, so this is me. That's Diamond Lake. It's my Bapa right there. Catching some walleye when I was a young man. One of my first memories and one of my favorite memories of him and of that time in my life. And then that's me, Colorado State, kicking some 9-year-old butt on the tennis court and winning the tournament in Fort Collins. And emulating my idol, the Beaver, and having my own paper out and rolling 86 papers and hitting mostly porches in what was then Northeast Colorado Springs. And then finally, tearing it up as a high school stud with a mustache and a burn orange Honda Civic. And somehow in 20 minutes, oops, hold on, sorry.
I got you.
Cool, thank you. I want to stop sharing. Were those visible?
I'm not so sure.
Some people are nodding, so okay. Anyway, so here I sit now, and you know, it's thank goodness some neurons are still kicking around up there, but there's not one single cell in this being that's talking to you now that was there on that dock in Minnesota with my Bapa catching fish. And to think to have 20 minutes to somehow get from there to here is certainly would allow us to have plenty of time for questions. Anyway, so I've spent some time on this and trying to determine what events, what people impacted me to take this path. And I certainly needed to consider the time I spent as a young man working as a Christian missionary volunteer. At one point, a group of us went up to Alaska and built a church on Yucatan Island. A bunch of men and myself went to Mendenhall, Mississippi, pretty much in the height of the civil rights movement, and built a nursery for the African-American population on the wrong side of the tracks down there. And then as a young man, I took my first airplane trip ever and went to Ethiopia. And out in the middle of the rainforest, working with some wonderful missionaries there, giving out smallpox vaccines and working on the irrigation systems and doing janitorial maintenance for the full-time missionaries. And then on a strange twist of circumstances, I assisted in the delivery of a stillborn baby with a missionary nurse who was way over her head and panicking and scared, and with a fellow female volunteer. And we prayed like crazy that day for a miracle, and only to have the baby never ever breathe. And that left a lot of questions in my mind as a young man, and changed some of my course. But in all those moments, I embraced the bodhicitta of the effort, any of those projects and so much more. I didn't know the word back then, but I did understand that desire. But I felt a real complete disconnect from the message we were extolling to the people we were working with. I couldn't articulate it then, and I really had no one to talk about it anyway. But deep inside of my heart, I knew that path was not really me. Surely these experiences weighed on my movement to seek elsewhere, but I also can say they weren't any more impactful in my personality or my path than being in seventh grade and feeling for the first time in my life not to be in the midst of the cool club. I can remember as if it was yesterday, maybe more vividly than actually standing on the dock with my bappa, how I felt on the playground of East Junior High, brand new seventh grader. All my hoped for friends were there. Dave and Curtis and Frasca and Mark and Kurt, and every one of those bastards were wearing Levi's. It was the, believe it or not, in 67, Levi's were the jeans of choice. It was what all the people wore. And I stood there in my Penny's brand jeans that my cheap ass dad said were just as good as the other pants that he went pay for $5 more. Which left me with the feeling of being on the outside and not being good enough. And that was in, sadly, that was in September of 1967. And that has never left the core of who I am. Surely the loneliness inside drew me to a series of really stupid overcompensations in my life. But at the same time, it was enormously important of how I received the welcoming of this Sangha when there was no person of rank, and I felt that maybe I could get past that. I think perhaps the objective of giving these talks is to acutely remind the speaker of how unlinear it all is and how blurred the lines are between cause and effect. I can point to some things, though, I know that had an impact. It's hard to delineate exactly what each did to me, but they have never left me. As a young person, I read Cahil Gibran's The Prophet. It was simply so different from anything I'd ever read in my life. It resonates with me still. When I told my youth pastor how much it meant to me, I honestly think he would have preferred I was watching porn than reading something that he thought was the antithesis of what the Christian religion was. There was Hunter S. Thompson. I know that seems maybe strange with his gonzo journalism, but Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas made me laugh when I was 18, 19. It still does. But maybe most importantly in my path, it gave me a sense that there were other equally legitimate ways to look at what people call reality and see things in a different light. There was Ansel Adams. His photographs inspired the heck out of me, and he made me want to pursue my what was I thought was going to be my lifelong career of being a photographer that really didn't work out. But I love the exposure and the focus that he had using a 4x5 or 8x10 camera. They made photographs that somehow, and it doesn't, I really can't quite understand it now, but they were almost impressionistic, like a Monet painting. They were so real, and at the same time, it made you look at mountains or sand dunes like you'd never actually seen them before. There was Tom Robbins, the author, a bit weird, but still Life with Woodpecker, and what was life-changing for me, even Cowgirls Get the Blues. There was a articulation at the end of that book where there was a tasting of vinegar, and the Buddha reacted that this is sweet. And probably from that one little phrase in my life, it made me think about a different way of looking at life and pursuing, at least doing some study about Eastern religions and Eastern philosophy. And then I know this probably isn't what everybody's talked about in their wayfaring talks, probably none of this has been so far, but there was Trudeau's Doonesbury, and there was a panel from the Walden series. If any of you guys are old enough to remember that, but Mark is in a boat in the pond in Walden, and there's reeds, and it is just pouring down rain, and his hat's all matted down over his head, and he kind of puts his hand out like he's figuring out whether or not it's raining, and he says, well, it's a good day for something. And honestly, I've lived my entire life based upon that. I really do believe every moment is a good day for something. I've tried to be a role model of that in my life. I will tell you quite candidly, the closest people in my life have never bought into it. My daughter rolls her eyes and just says, geez, Dad. And my wife, you know, God love her, she'll walk the dogs with me in the morning when the snow is spitting and the wind is blowing. And Jack, our mixed shepherd, turns his head and wants to go home while I say something like, isn't this great? Or man, this is so invigorating and different than yesterday. And Susie smiles and says, no, Regan, with the knowledge as much as she loves me, she's younger than me and I will be gone before her and she can live a life in a sane world. So anyway, here I am. I titled this talk, if you can call it a title, by doing a, I guess I should stop. Can everybody hear me and stuff? Are we good?
Yep.
All right. It's so weird with dead silence, but I'm sure this is riveting. Anyway, so I titled with a haiku that has never left me once I read it. I've sent it to so many friends in so many different situations, but it's also meant the world to me. And pausing halfway up the stair, white chrysanthemums. And, you know, in my life, I've had some suffering. I'm pretty sure there's not a lot of value in trying to compare lives, who's had the hardest life or who's had the biggest tragedy. I just don't think there's a scale for that. I think each of us rightly believes our suffering has been real and very intense. And what I love about this haiku, is it not only recognizes pain and hardship, but embraces it. It is hard to go up the stairs of our lives. It's just hard. Whether it's a stupid decision I made when I was 23 years old to join a restaurant company to make some money as a manager instead of doing my last year of college, and then feeling trapped for years in a profession I didn't feel was my calling. To go through years where the most wonderful thing in my life, my daughter, was almost unrecognizable and so harsh to me and so sad. It's still tendered in my nerves right now. I don't know if I'll ever outlive that. The number of nights I spent in those years pathetically singing along with Lucinda Williams' song, Are You All Right? You know, there was my dad who, to be fair, he did have a heart attack and he did have quadruple bypass surgery, but every doctor and every nurse and every person we talked to said that he certainly was capable of recovering and that there was a good chance that he would actually have a better life than he'd had the last 4 or 5 years before having that. But my dad was not really a man of great strength and didn't have the fortitude and really just chose to not do that, to not rehab, and he died. I was amazed at the time how quickly a decision to not live resulted in his death. It left my mom in a very tough spot emotionally that she's never recovered from, and it wasn't too great for me or my sister either, or my daughter or my wife. And then most recently in the last 6-7 months, after 27 years, I lost my job. And the company went bankrupt shortly thereafter, and all the money I had invested in the stocks that I were promised ended up being worth zero. So not what you'd call a great situation. And then as painful as that was, as I tried to get back in the game, some options came up. There was a chance to join a restaurant group in Wisconsin, and there was a chance to open my own restaurant here with a good buddy of mine who's a restaurateur in Colorado. And COVID-19 erased all of that and more. And then there's the suffering, and I know it probably will feel different than the rest of the things I mentioned, but the suffering of working with Collins. But there, at least for me, there's just some days where there's just real despair where I feel completely at sea. They don't make sense. It doesn't come together. There's just no way to express it. And of course, it always seems that work in the room is scheduled for a day away. But the word which changes all those for me is the word pausing in the haiku. I guess it could be synonymous with sazen or mindful breathing or awakening. But in the aforementioned scenarios, when I paused, when I allowed myself not to repeat the emotions of anger, of fear, of regret, every time there was beauty, joy, and even happiness there to meet me. Those early restaurant years where I was frustrated about making the wrong choice, to be fair, there was always someone there who liked me or respected me, cared for me enough that somehow I was taught how life works, how business works, and to find out in life what's important and how to discern wheat from chaff. My daughter got enough of her shit together in the middle of the worst times on Christmas Day when I was in the hospital recovering from a spinal fusion and was not, I don't know if there was the worst day in my life in terms of my emotions and pain. And she made me laugh, and she honestly, earnestly told me she loved me. It changed everything. I told you my dad kind of gave up and chose to die, but the day before he died, we didn't know it was going to be the day before, but I brought in he was an old DJ way back in the day, and he, like me, couldn't sing a note and couldn't clap on time, but we both loved their music. Anyway, I brought in a selection of songs. My sister was there from out of town, and my wife and my daughter and my mom, of course. And we brought in some songs that we used to sing in the car on road trips. There was the old Rugged Cross. There was even Alan Sherman's, if you remember, Camp Granada. And there was 500 Miles and Cotton Fields. And man, we sat in that hospice room in Penrose on the, I think it's the 11th floor, looking west. And we laughed. And even he laughed. And we cried. And he cried. And as we finished, somewhat interestingly enough, I guess, the flames, that was the night that the first flames from the Walden Fire hit the top of the mountain, started their way down towards Rock Rimmon. The disaster of not getting the positions I told you about in the job situation, well, the one in Madison with the COVID virus, they've already announced that they probably will not reopen. If they do, it'll just be one or two of the restaurants out of the six or eight that I was to run. And my position would have disappeared and I'd be living in Madison, Wisconsin without a job. The other option I told you about was to invest everything and open this restaurant. We would have been opening the restaurant in 2 weeks in the middle of this deal. So in all those situations, there's certainly, when we take a pause, there's some light chrysanthemums. And with call-on work, you know, there's that pain and the frustration, but there's also that amazing joy, even in the midst of the frustration. And there's a sense of some little bit of awakening, and there's that sense of non-self and emptiness and inner being and all that. And there's an amazing bouquet of white chrysanthemums in the heart of that. So that's kind of where I am. There's probably worth some conversation about some of all that background and how did Zen or how did Buddhism become part of my life. This is probably like 14, 15 years ago. I was doing yoga really every day, and I was taking class a couple of times a week. And I was then, I am now, an avid reader. And one of my teachers in the yoga class emphasized meditation as part of her class. And one night she brought in Lucinda, what was her name? Lucinda, I forgot, all of a sudden.
Lucinda Green.
Thank you. Brought Lucinda Green in, and thank you. And she talked to us. Someone's paid attention, and that was a changing deal. And then I read the books. Jack Kornfield, A Path with Heart. I know it's not a Zen book, but it still was life changing, and it still resonates with me. And there was Thich Nhat Hanh's Pieces Every Step, and I was probably more challenged than inspired, but it made me think differently. The books by Robert Thurman and Dalai Lama. I would tell you that Zen mind, beginner's mind, I'm not sure in the last 10 or 12 years of my life has really ever left my bedside. So anyway, we did have that meeting with her and with Lucinda, and from that I took a series of classes with her at Divine Redeemer up there on Shelton Road, but way up there. You know, it was really helpful. What was my sporadic attempts at meditation became structured. And it was really great to have community. And to be fair, it wasn't due to any lack of being welcomed or challenged by her or the group. But I think I was just really in search mode. I was really in the more rabid stages of being a wayfarer. And to be honest, I never really felt completely home with the insight emphasis on my awakening and maybe not so much of the bodhicitta. Anyway, during this time, I ran into a friend at Wooglin's Deli. It might have been actually after one of my yoga classes. But anyway, he told me about his Zen group that met on Mondays at Chove Chapel. And so the next Monday I went in not knowing what to expect. I guess it was maybe in hindsight, it was that not knowing which is the most intimate. To be truthful, I found it a bit austere. The amount of meditation, the lack of much of a talk, just kind of a coolness, it seemed like, in that first impression. So I got up at the end and wasn't really sure if I was ever really going to come back and do that again. And I was packing up my stuff, and this smallish woman came up to me, Elizabeth. And I really can't remember a lot about what she said, but I remember her smile. And I somehow, I just somehow knew I'd found a home. and I haven't, I've left for moments, but I've never, ever really left. I've been a member for over 10 years now, and the path has certainly been a ride of pretty wild swings in terms of level of involvement and commitment. But I've always been nourished by Sarah and what she has to say and who she is as a person, but also some many members of the Sangha. If I start to name names, I'm going to leave so many people out, the people that I love and care for so much and mean the world to me, and then certainly my practice over those years. So with the remaining time I have, and I think I'm actually kind of on time, which is weird, really weird for me, but I did practice this. I'd share some color of my practice. I recently read a wonderful book by Brian Greene. It's called Until the End of Time. And to be, so you guys are clear, I understood maybe a third of it, and that was after reading most pages four or five times, but he pretty much describes the existence from 13.8 billion years ago to 10 to the 50th year from now. Spoiler alert for those of you that hadn't read the book, but the universe ends. Anyway, it had a start about 197 million lifetimes of mine ago, and it will have an end. And somewhere in there, somewhere in that span is us humans, you and me, and this moment. And I've been meditating lately on the lack of forever before and the lack of forever forward. And it's amazingly humbling, somewhat scary, I think. But more importantly, it has been truly inspiring. It has been white chrysanthemums. Brian Greene writes, as we hurtle toward a cold and barren cosmos, we must accept there is no grand design. Particles are not endowed with a purpose. Yet certain collections, certain special collections of particles can think and feel and reflect. And within these subjective worlds, they can create a purpose. So the only direction is to look inward. That is the noble direction to look. In the end, during our brief moment in the sun, we are tasked with the noble charge of finding our own meaning. This reflects so much of what my view of life is, how precious each moment is, and how we have to find that meaning within ourselves. It stirs within me a thought of Nagarjuna's, this emptiness is not a negation of life, rather it gives a glimpse of what enables anything to happen at all. The possible nihilistic interpretation of particles nothing with of not having a purpose, or the Buddhist sense of emptiness, instead blossoms into the white chrysanthemums of endless possibilities. So with that, I'm not trying to hide or cover up my flaws, but rather be vulnerable. When I'm able to do that, I find myself bowing to the Buddha of my bad habits, the teacher Manjushri of my grief. And I'm challenged by the five remembrances and the awareness that my actions are my only true belongings. And it echoes when I recall the words of Pema Chodron, if your aim is to wake up for the benefit of ourselves and other living beings, what we basically say in our vows every week, I guess it's maybe my emphasis, but then it is necessary for us to change. If our aim is to wake up for the benefit of ourselves and other living beings, then it is necessary for us to change. I think back, I gave a wayfaring talk, it must have been 8 years ago, maybe 10, and I'm sure if I look back, I wrote a lot of the same things. And I have found that internally, I don't see the changes that much. Sometimes I feel a difference. Sometimes I sense a bit of insight. But people around me would tell you that I'm different than I was 8 years ago. I'm not so sure they would say it's a matter of being better. I don't think that would be the adjective they would use so much as that I'm just different. And I've come to realize in the last few years that maybe like you, I embrace and I extol the parts of Zen that pretty much agree with my view of life. but somehow find a way to ignore or debate the ones that don't seem to fit. By being honest about that, the past year I've been able to find out that some of those things that I've rejected have been my greatest teacher. I took the vows years ago. When I was done, Linda Hodges came up to me and gave me this little tiny bell with a leather, I don't know what you call it, that had it ring. Still sits on my altar to this day. And in that moment, after taking the vows and taking them seriously, it was a new day. And I wrote my own vows like a lot of you have, and they were sincere at the time. But as time has gone on, I mean, it certainly seems to make a lot of sense not to kill or to steal, or to lie. But, you know, to not get intoxicated and don't indulge anger and some of those other ones and other things that come up in the Buddhist philosophy and religion. I mean, I get it theoretically, but really, is that how we're really supposed to be? And sitting with them and working with them, I can't tell you the answers I've found, but pausing, there have been white chrysanthemums. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to give you a few closing thoughts. Wherever you happen to be on the path, I can just tell you from my perspective, for me, what my truth is, I guess, is that more than retreats, more than meetings, more than one-on-ones, more than conversation, the work of koans is just of uncomparable benefit. It's amazing to me how even after getting through a koan and going to the next one and the next one, months, weeks, even years later in a situation's, in a situation that's essence will come filtering back somewhat uninvited just there for the moment. I think about the ultimate path is without difficulty. Just avoid picking and choosing. Just don't love or hate, and you'll be lucid and clear. As you look at your buddy while arguing the best route to take on your hike that day. And then I breathe. White chrysanthemums are there. And I take a step following his. I'm convinced more than ever I don't want to waste my life taking myself too seriously or so seriously. I'll certainly take the Bodhisattva vows seriously, but me and my issues, I just don't have the time. I remember Norman Fisher's wisdom when he said, our attitude is the climate of our lives. He said, our attitude is the climate of our lives. And I believe attitude really is a choice. And I want a climate where white chrysanthemums grow in abundance, that I take time to pause. And no matter how hard it is and what a struggle it is, that I walk up the stair. So here I am. Rilke wrote, I want to unfold. I don't want to stay folded anywhere, because where I am folded, there I am a lie. I don't want to be a lie. Annie Lamott, one of my favorite writers, wrote about how people say that a broken bone grows stronger. And she says, and I would agree, I'm sure that's true in a lot of cases, that could be true, but I can tell you that my knee replacements don't really let me do the things I could do before. My fused back limits activities that used to be easy. My experience with loved ones and friends and fights and breaking up and hardships and pain, well, big parts of me got broken. And when I look at the COVID virus, part of my heart, my mind, my entire being are broken. But she says, and I would echo as loudly as I could, yet we keep getting up, lurching on. We dance with a limp. I think back to that little boy on the dock. Not one cell is left. So much has happened in this life. But I keep getting up, lurching on, and I dance with the limp. I pause, and in the suffering there is joy. In the happiness there is sorrow. I dance on. White chrysanthemums.